Ladies and gentlemen, this is a mini momentous occasion. For the last 18 and a half years, this broadcast has been unique. Can't be fairly unique. It's unique among public radio broadcasts in that you've never heard anybody say, except in jest,
funds for this program were supplied by the...
There's never been a funding credit or an underwriting notice at the beginning or the end of this program. I don't know why. Nothing was solicited. Nothing was offered. This has changed. Everything has changed, and this is part of it. Today, for the first time, you will hear such an announcement at the end of this program, and I'm only pointing it out to say it's not a joke. So, you know, because everything here is, we're just kidding around. But that's, people actually put serious something on the table. I don't know. I don't see any of it. But something went somewhere to provide for that announcement. So when you hear it at the end of the program today, just hit the little button in your brain that says, oh, he's not kidding about this. And you know what? I'm not kidding about one other thing, too, ladies and gentlemen. This will be the penultimate opportunity for me to pull your coat, as Sammy used to say, about the fact that a week and a half from today, Friday, March 29th, L.A., New York, San Francisco, maybe a week later in San Francisco, I don't know. A little film I directed, comedy film, is opening, and you won't hear about it probably anywhere else on this station because, you know, sometimes certain things aren't considered. What can I tell you? But if you like me, or you just plain are like me, it's called Teddy Bear's Picnic, and it opens March. And I really am not kidding about that. Really, really. I can't underline for you how much I'm not kidding about that. But the rest of the show, sure I'm kidding, because hello, welcome to the show.
Says you're doing everything you can, and I'm glad that she won't get the joke. You're as free as a 10-year-old with a room of your very own. It doesn't matter at all what all those people say at home. With your good humor, you're a hero. Stop and dragging you down. They got nothing better to do. Sometimes you've got to laugh in their faces. Laugh in their faces. Laugh in their faces. Come on. Guitar is in hock. Doesn't matter if you always saw the lock, 'cause you're getting happier by the minute. And they wouldn't have a clue about what it's like to be lazy when you got too much to do. Got too much to do. And you can stop them dragging you down. They got nothing better to do. Sometimes you've got a laugh in their faces. Laugh in their faces. Laugh in their faces. Come on, laugh in their faces.
In their faces.
Stop and dragging you down. They got nothing better to do. Sometimes you've gotta laugh in their faces.
Mr. Saturday Dance, heard that crowd in the floor. I couldn't bear it without you, baby. Don't get around much anymore. I thought I'd visit the club. I got as far as the door. I said, darling, I guess my mind is more at ease. But nevertheless, why stir up her memories? I've been invited on dates. Might have gone, but what for? It's awfully different without you, honey, now. Don't get around much anymore. Somebody play the blues for me. I said, darling, I guess this mind is more at ease. But nevertheless, why stir up memories? I've been invited on dates. Might have gone, but what for? It's awfully different without you, baby. Don't get around much anymore, baby. It's only different. Don't get around much anymore. Sha-la-la-la.
It's cozy in the park tonight. When you cuddle up and hold me tight, stars above, they seem to know we're putting on the late, late show. Hear the crazy music in the trees, see the flowers dancing in the breeze. Old man moon begins to glow, he's joining in the late, late show. Birds that should be dreaming
starting chirping a song. While fireflies are gleaming, we kiss, kiss all night long. Then we amble back to your front door, say goodnight, and then we kiss some more. Guess you know I like you so. It started on the Late Late Show. Should be dreaming, starting chirping a song. While fireflies are gleaming, we kiss, kiss all night long. Then we amble back to your front door, say goodnight, and then we kiss some more. Guess you know I like you so. It started on the Late Late Show.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer. This is Le Show. And it's time, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get right into it because this we want to make I, there's no we here, there's only an I, want to make sure we have time today for the Tales of Airport Security. So, first up on the broadcast, our regular feature, the Apologies of the Week.
We're so sorry.
Starting down under. Well, that is to say geographically, the Australian telephone monopoly Telstra, I believe it's a monopoly, could be a duopoly, who knows, they admitted this week that their systems need substantial improvement. The head of the phone company, Ziggy Switkowski, that's right, the head of the Australian telephone company is named Ziggy Switkowski, told reporters that, well, a 10-year-old child, Sam Boulding, died from an asthma attack in his home when his family was unable to call an ambulance because repeated requests to the phone company to fix their phone went unheeded. Ziggy said the death was a terrible tragedy. We're going to deal with Mrs. Boulding and her family in a compassionate and sensitive way. I have talked to Ms. Boulding. I have apologized on each occasion for the fact that the Telstra service was not working at that critical time. We may never know whether a working phone would have produced a different result. So he's apologized, but is not committed to paying for paying compensation. But, you know, a phone company saying they're sorry, that's worth something. Senator Jesse Helms has clarified his recent apology about his inaction on the AIDS epidemic. It does not mean, he says, he's altered his views on homosexuality or his belief that government spending on AIDS research is excessive compared to spending on other illnesses. He says his comments about being ashamed he's too lax in doing something really significant about AIDS was focused on the epidemic in sub-Saharan Africa, didn't apply to AIDS in this country involving homosexuals. If I had extended to them, I would have said no, I would have said so, he said. That conference was about AIDS in Africa. So he's sorry, but not that sorry. The BBC, ladies and gentlemen, it's sorry. The chairman of the BBC Board of Governors, Gavin Davies, was forced this week to withdraw remarks in which he accused the British southern white middle classes of attempting to hijack the BBC. He said this week that allegations of dumbing down came largely from southern white middle class, middle-aged, and well-educated people who consumed a disproportionate amount of BBC services. He said he's sorry if his remarks have been misinterpreted. On the other hand, he's probably not sorry that if his remarks were interpreted correctly. Billy Graham's organization this week issued a longer apology regarding the tape of his conversation with Richard Nixon 30 years ago in which he knocked the Jews. His original apology was a little brief. Now he says, I don't ever recall having those feelings about any group, especially the Jews, and I certainly do not have them now. My remarks did not reflect my love for the Jewish people. Billy Graham, ladies and gentlemen. I humbly ask the Jewish community to reflect on my actions on behalf of Jews over the years that contradict my words in the Oval Office that day. Mr. Graham's statement this week expressed hope he had grown past his words that day in the Oval Office. I hope so, too. Billy, you and me both, babe. So, that's the apology roundup for this week. An astonishing interview with the wife of Osama bin Laden has revealed his attempts to manage his complicated domestic life while planning his terrorist campaign against the United States. See? Now, this will give you the other side, the other view. Because George W. Bush has only one woman to come home to. Osama? He's got his hands full, ladies and gentlemen. Like many husbands, he often came home late from work and was irritated if his wife tried to talk to him. The woman, identified only as A.S., spoke to a London-based Arabic weekly, Al Majalla, on condition her location remain a secret. Apparently also her name. She says her husband suffered from kidney and stomach ailments, ugh, and had his children educated privately after the Taliban closed down the schools. Oh, I see. So Mullah Omar had CDs in his car after he banned music, and Osama had his children in private schools after they closed down the schools. Not a whiff of anything there. She said during the last period he is constantly worried and looked tired and exhausted due to the lack of sleep. Most days he was taking medicine and sleeping pills to help him go to sleep. Her husband would visit him once a week, said Mrs. bin Laden, taking it in turn to see his different wives. You see, there's more than one Mrs. bin Laden. He never mentioned any plan to attack the United States. Well, they don't talk. She claims to have last seen him before the September events. He came to the house, gave me a telephone, told me to call my family and tell them we were going somewhere else, and there would be no news of me for a long time. She's sure he hasn't been killed. Doesn't say how she knows, but that's the word from Mrs. bin Laden, from Mrs. bin Laden number one. We'd like to hear from Mrs. bin Laden's 2, 3, and 4, if they'd care to comment. You know, the comment line is always open. Somewhere. Not here. We don't have one. But somewhere. Ladies and gentlemen, following up on why winter is flu season, nobody knows. Here's a listener, John. He writes, the fellow's theory last week about the dry winter air degrading nasal passages and allowing pathogens to thereby enter the body is only the first part of the answer. My nasal passages, John is now telling us more than we want to know about him, my nasal passages are quite sensitive to dry air. So much so that summer air in the mountains and desert can cause minor nasal bleeding. John! We're eating sometime today. But I get no colds in the summer. When the air is colder, however, my nose tends to run. Perhaps this is an evolutionary adaptation designed to protect against winter's dry air. The excess moisture in the nasal passages caused by the cold air creates a medium for cold pathogens to thrive and provides the means of transmission of the cold upon sneezing. Thus, cold air equals moisture equals germs equals dinner. Okay? So that's an American checking in. Here are the Canadians from a Canadian website called Flu Watch. Technically, influenza is not bound by seasons and can occur all year round in tropical climates. However, in temperate climates like those found in Canada. What? It's temperate in Canada? I thought it was freezing. That's temperate. Where would extreme be then? Now, I know the Arctic, but seriously, temperate climates, I'm just pausing here in the reading of this to expostulate with surprise about the idea that it's temperate in Canada. Maybe the people are. The climate, however. However, I'm going to read now again. In temperate climates like those found in Canada, influenza is mainly a winter disease. It is not entirely understood why influenza occurs mostly in the winter months. As far as I've been able to determine so far, it's not at all understood, but we'll continue here with the Canadians. However, it is probably a result of several factors. Cold outdoor air as well as heated indoor air can cause drying of the respiratory tissues, and this may leave us more susceptible to respiratory viruses, the drying of the passages theory again. Also, influenza viruses may survive longer in the drier indoor air, and there is more opportunity for influenza to spread when people gather indoors during the winter. Again, how about people gathering indoors in the South all summer long, babe, where it's really temperate? by babe, I mean A. For example, it is known that when many people traveling from different parts of the world, some bringing influenza with them, gather together in closed spaces, such as on a cruise ship or in an airplane, the chances of being infected are greater. An example of this was the out-of-season outbreak on an Alaskan cruise ship during the summer of 1999. So much for Flu Watch. From Canada, ladies and gentlemen, where it's temperate. Don't you know? Let's see. News from across the pond. Reason to maybe make your plane reservations now. Medical experts gave the go-ahead this week for Britain to reclassify marijuana as low risk in the latest in a series of moves relaxing attitudes toward soft drugs. In a report to the Home Secretary, medical experts from an advisory council on the misuse of drugs said all marijuana preparations should be downgraded to Class C, the lowest risk grouping of controlled drugs. Classing it as any higher risk was disproportionate, the report said. The downgrade would put it in the same category as anabolic steroids and growth hormones. Who smokes growth hormones? The government has made no final decision as to whether to reclassify the drug. They have no plan to decriminalize or legalize it. Class A drugs, according to a government spokesman, the most harmful category, including ecstasy, cocaine, crack cocaine, and heroin, account for 99% of the cost to society of drug use. Researchers said that relaxing British marijuana laws could save about $71 million a year and free up the equivalent of 500 police officers. Government data in Britain show the use of marijuana has increased dramatically over the past two decades. And more than a dozen Dutch-style marijuana cafes are being planned from Brecon to Glasgow in a major movement across Britain. They range from converted warehouses to upmarket cafes in London with budgets of $300,000. This is in the wake of that report. Campaigners are setting up coffee shops confident that such a move of downgrading is now all but inevitable. The deputy mayor of Rail in North Wales, speaking about plans to convert a coffee shop to a marijuana cafe, said the plan beggars belief. The proprietor promptly named his coffee shop the Beggar's Belief. Doesn't slow down reaction time, apparently. And let's be scared, department, ladies and gentlemen. Let's be very scared. Can we please? Half of all the male fish in British lowland rivers are changing sex as a result of pollution. Alarming, new official research suggests. The findings raise serious questions as to whether the pollution is getting into drinking water and affecting human fertility, or just increasing the sale of large size gowns. The research shows that male fish are developing female characteristics in rivers all over Britain. In some stretches, all the male fish have been feminized. Scientists conducting the research blame a particularly powerful form of estrogen in urine from the contraceptive pill, which is flushed through sewage works into the rivers. Some fear that the exquisitely potent chemical may be contaminating part of one-third of all of Britain's drinking water that is taken from rivers. The water industry strongly denies that this situation could damage health. But the fish in Britain are changing sex, ladies and gentlemen. Just trying to keep up with the members of Parliament, as far as I can tell. But now it's time for us to see what you've been saying about airport security. Tales of airport security for your listening pleasure, ladies and gentlemen. Here on the show program. Peter writes, last week I was flying through Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport wearing jeans and a belt. I took everything off my person that I had, including a wallet with all my cards and nearly $100 worth of cash. Apparently the brand of jeans I was wearing used a button and stylistic rivets to attach pockets that set off the now more sensitive electronic gates. Though a sound never registered, I was pulled aside. I thought it was just one of those random things, but apparently a light had registered me as a threat, so I was wanded and patted, forced to remove my Chuck Thompson's, I guess those are his jeans, which weren't deemed a threat in Phoenix 2 months earlier. No, I guess those are his shoes. Two things I don't understand. If the buzzer only went off around my belt and my pockets, which were visibly empty, why did I have to be patted down everywhere? And secondly, while I was being felt up by a cute young guy, my wallet and $1,000 camera were sitting at the end of the security conveyor belt where anyone could have walked off with them, and no one would have noticed. Cheryl writes, as I waited in line to board an AirTran flight in Fort Lauderdale in January, a young American woman was ahead of me with a baby on her hip and a toddler in tow. A Hispanic gentleman was taking tickets and checking IDs. She handed him a driver's license and explained that her husband was already aboard and they had accidentally switched IDs. The man was clearly confused by this and wouldn't let her pass. She then whispered to him, "He's the agent." When this didn't register, she repeated, "He's FBI, the onboard agent." Meanwhile, her kids are going nuts. The toddler caught loose when she dug in her pocket for her ID is running away from her. The gate agent then radioed co-workers on the plane and pulled her out of line. From John, on a recent business trip with several colleagues, I was traveling out of the Portland, Oregon airport. This was about 9 p.m. on a Friday. After being on the road for several days, we were tired and anxious to get home. We boarded our outbound flight, which was full, managed to find room for our carry-on items, and nestled in for the journey. Before closing the doors, a security person appeared at the front of the plane and informed us that there had been a security problem. We would all need to deplane and return with all our belongings to inside the terminal and wait for further instructions. After much grumbling, everyone gathered their carry-on items and slowly filed off the plane. I was one of the last ones to leave, and as I was leaving, I overheard the security person letting the gate agent have it for allowing a person selected for search at the gate to stray onto the plane. Obviously, fearing that the unsearched person could have slipped something onto the plane, everyone had to get off. They searched the entire plane, and then they searched this person, as well as researched all those others who had been previously searched. Then and only then were we allowed to continue on our merry way. I recently traveled to New York over New Year's weekend. In my locked baggage, I had two Eckerd's reusable cameras. They were only $9.99 each, but my lock was cut off my luggage, and both of the cameras were removed from my baggage. I did not realize the issue until I went to use them on New Year's Eve. So beware, not only do they remove the items, they cut off your lock and dispose of them. That's from Florida. For my Minneapolis to Phoenix flight on December 20th, I put my keys in my jacket pocket and put that on the conveyor just to keep things simple. I'd forgotten that my keys had a folding tool with a scissors and a little knife. I gave it up when the X-ray attendant asked me about it because it wasn't worth the hassle to keep it at that point. Later at boarding, I was randomly pulled aside for a check there. The inspectors found in my jacket pocket a similar folding pliers tool with a fold-out knife I had found in a parking lot a few days earlier and had forgotten about. Work on your memory there, babe. The first security station had missed that weapon altogether. This is from Andy in Wisconsin. This is from Michael. I moved to America from Britain the day after the bombing of Afghanistan started. Airport security at Heathrow was pretty firm but fair, and I boarded a near-capacity flight without much hassle. Flight was casual enough. On nearing San Francisco, it became alarmingly casual. Over the speakers and the honeyed tones of a local radio announcer, the pilot announced that in aid of the Red Cross 9/11 fund, there was going to be an auction. The prize? The chance to sit up in the cockpit while the pilot landed the plane and enjoy a drop of champagne. Winning bid, $50. After enduring 2 hours of lines at LAX on Tuesday, Feb 19th, I got to sit around for another couple of hours to board. Once on board United 94 to Philadelphia, we got our safety lecture and video and breakfast. When they tried to start the movie, the video worked, but there was no audio. After several attempts at fixing the problem by the flight attendants, the pilot finally came out to take a look. For about 6 or 7 minutes, the newly Kevlar-reinforced cockpit door swung back and forth, the crew there for all to see and jump, all in order to see a bad Bruce Willis movie. Hey, I don't think there's any such thing as a bad Bruce Willis movie, you? They finally gave up, went back into their space, and we had a quiet flight to Philly. I felt so safe knowing bad videos are the priority in the friendly skies. Finally, from Mark. My wife and I flew from San Francisco to Miami, which was a couple of days after SFO security was officially federalized. I'm a full-time wheelchair user, but often travel by air. Everything went pretty well until we got to the gate. Wheelchairs can't go through the metal detector and always get a hand check. The guard, who looked to be about 20, patted me down head to feet. He had me remove my hat and looked inside. He had me remove both shoes, looking into each and then rapping on each on a counter to see if anything would fall out. He even had me lift my sweater and felt with his hand behind my belt buckle, actually putting his hand inside the front of my pants. After all this, he gave me the go-ahead. Despite all that inspection, he never looked in the large carry bag hanging in plain view from the wheelchair frame behind my knees. This is a common bag used by many wheelchair users for car keys, wallet, etc., and large enough to conceal whatever. I pointed out to the guard I had this large bag he hadn't inspected. He looked sheepish while I showed him it was empty. He barely looked before waving me through to the gate. Tales of Airport Security for your listening pleasure here on Le Show. Where else? Well, you know where else. I've told you that.
She sang the best she'd ever sang. She couldn't ever sing any better. But Mr. Davidson never rang. She knew he would forget her. She'd seen him there and put herself to ransom. He had stared, he really was quite handsome. She had really looked her best. She could never look any better, but she knew she'd failed the test. She knew he would forget her. Triumphant was the way she felt as she acknowledged the applause. Triumphant was the way she felt when she saw him at the dressing room door. She was happier than she'd ever been as he praised her for her grace. But his expression changed, she had seen, as he leant to kiss her face. It ended there. He claimed a late appointment. She quickly turned to hide her disappointment. She ripped her glittering gown, couldn't face another show, no. Her deodorant had let her down. She should have used powder, oh no.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for us to check out the property. There's hot property locally and in Colorado. Latin recording sensation Louis Miguel has sold his Beverly Hills home to fashion designer and fragrance mogul Bijan. For $6 million in cash, Miguel is looking to buy a smaller home because he no longer needs 12,000 square feet of living space, sources said. Bijan, on the other hand, wanted more room than he had in his Bel Air home. He'd been looking for a home to buy for 6 years since his divorce. In 1999, Bijan sold a Beverly Hills home he never lived in to Lionel Richie. It was too old of a style for Bijan, his spokesman explained. Rock star Tom Petty has purchased a home in Malibu for close to its asking price of $2.5 million. Built on a sandy beach, it has 3 bedrooms, 2 of which face the ocean. It also has 3 bedrooms, 3 fireplaces, Malibu tiles, how appropriate, an open floor plan, and a courtyard with a fountain. And Fred Durst, frontman of the rock band Limp Bizkit, tell your kids, has sold his Bel Air home for, or ask them at least, has sold his Bel Air home for $3.7 million. He bought the home last fall and never moved into it. Who does he think he is, Bijan? The house had vibes that were not quite correct for him, said sources not involved in the transaction. Let's see, it had 4 bedrooms, 6,600 square feet, slightly more than an acre. It was once owned by Robbie Krieger of the Doors, and there's a stone carving on a wall of the Doors performing. Well, question answered. Now, to Aspen, where Army Secretary Thomas White, a former Enron Corporation vice chairman, sold his Aspen mansion this week for $6.5 million, more than $1 million less than what he paid for it nearly 17 months ago. Enron guy took a bath. The buyer's having nothing to do with Enron. It's a 3-level, 8,700-square-foot Maroon Creek Club home. White and his wife put the home up for sale December 11th, 9 days after Enron filed for bankruptcy. And Ken Lay. Ken Lay, the former chief executive officer of the self-same Enron, have a home which has gone under contract. I guess that's the Colorado equivalent of escrow. 14,000, Ken and Linda, square foot home in Oklahoma Flats, the neighborhood of Aspen. It would leave, if this sells, it would leave him with only one remaining Aspen property. Of course, last month they unloaded their Shady Lane cottage in Aspen. This home, it was bought for $4.8 million. Now, we don't know what he's going to sell this one for. Well, it has been offered for $7 million, but the purchase price has not been disclosed. 5 bedrooms, 5 bathrooms, 14,000 square feet lot. The buyer, according to a broker, says, I think they're paying full price. So $7 million for a home that he paid $4 million for. Ken's not doing that bad, ladies and gentlemen. Ken's... You know, not doing that bad. Somebody who's not doing quite as well. Paula Jones.
I have an opportunity to do anything I want to do, but I still am the soccer mom and the baseball mom. They had practice this afternoon, actually, before I came on the show.
But I thought the whole...
But being somebody in the spotlight comes with different opportunities. And why shouldn't I have the opportunity to do that when it takes time? But, I mean, you know, when it comes my way. But I don't generally... I've had a lot of opportunities to do stuff, and I don't take all those opportunities. Just different interviews and stuff like that that I could possibly get out just to get me out there, you know. But I chose not to do that. But I thought this would be fun, and it paid some money, and I thought this would be fun to try.
What kind of money do they pay for this?
I can't tell how much they paid.
Something Paula Jones can't tell. Interesting. She's of course talking about celebrity boxing, where she squared off against... Tanya Harding, who beat the, didn't beat all the crap out of her, obviously. And on the Menken Watch, yes, you're right. 17 million people watched celebrity boxing on Fox. Now, let's just be clear about this. What was on opposite it? What did they choose not to watch? World Wrestling Federation Divas on UPN. Amazing Race 2 on CBS. A rerun of The West Wing. They'd already seen it. And almost as many people watched that rerun as watched celebrity boxing anyway. And Drew Carey and The Job. All right. So, maybe Menken was right that time. Now, apropos of Fox, Vivendi Universal has filed a $1 billion lawsuit this week accusing Rupert Murdoch's NDS Group of cracking its security system and encouraging digital TV piracy. Jean Messier, head of Vivendi Universal, which has this pay TV service in Europe, and claims that Rupert Murdoch's NDS group distributed published the cracked code on the internet, helping people bilk more than $1 billion from Vivendi Universal. Now, I've done business with both these organizations, Rupert's and Mr. Messier's, and it saddens me to see them in court, in a lawsuit. When there's so many better ways to settle these kinds of disputes. For example,
the first time borderline celebrities climbed into the ring to mix it up, it was fun. This time, it's personal. Jean doesn't like Rupert.
I see his ugly Australian face in the ring. I punch it like an overripe honeydew, except he's already scattered his seeds.
Rupert can't stand Jean.
Oh, he's a kind of French pipsqueak that like collaborating with the Nazis. I may not load my gloves with metal studs when I face this mime of a mogul, but I just might.
Celebrity boxing just got a whole lot richer and meaner. Fox presents a night of pugilism that would make Mike Tyson blush. Because for one night only, it's 3 rounds, no headgear, and no refs. Rupert Murdoch.
I'd love it if they carried him out in Ziploc pouches.
Jean Messier.
Make him wish that he did have a union health plan.
Plus, an exciting undercard featuring Ken Lay versus the head of Arthur Anderson. Lawsuits, they're for sissies. For the rest of us, there's executive celebrity boxing coming this May. Because you can never be too young or too fox.
Some plain roses to keep my love sweet. Let it be early, late or soon, I will enjoy my rose in June. Rose in June, rose in June, I will enjoy my rose in Let it be early, later soon. never so sweet as kisses can be when true lovers meet. Let it be early, late or soon, I will enjoy my rose in June. Rose in June, rose in June, I will enjoy my rose in June.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Ted Koppel, David Letterman thing has been settled. Dave announced this week that he was staying at CBS. Ted's staying at ABC for the nonce, although he wrote a memo this week saying, well, that it would be hard for the whole Nightline gang to do their job with a full commitment if they didn't get a commitment from ABC for a long-term security of the show, excuse me, Nightline. There was a conversation between Michael Eisner, head of Disney, and Ted Koppel, I guess a phone conversation in which Eisner voiced his support of the show, but gave Koppel nothing like the long-term commitment that Koppel, in his memo, was kind of demanding. And if he couldn't get any satisfaction from Eisner, I guess his only choice would be to walk upstairs and see the big guy.
Ted, you'll see you now.
Thanks very much, Goofy.
Oh, that's okay. It's my job.
Well, good morning, sir.
Ted, sit down. Don't stand there like a... like a statue judging me.
Well, thank you, Mr. Miles. I wasn't judging you, far from it. I think, if anything, you've been judging me and my broadcast.
Okay, first, let's get things straight. There are no broadcasts. Everything, if we work it right, everything is on broadcast TV, cable TV, DVD. I mean, the only thing we don't repurpose 8 Ways to Sunrise is the surveillance videos of you taking a crap.
Well,
you get my drift here, newsboy? No broadcasts. All there is are shows. Some shows are in a theme park with minimum wage kids wearing big heads. Some shows are on sets in Washington where the anchor is paid more money than Minnie on maternity leave. And he's got big hair. But they're all shows.
All right, sir. Well, I guess we're here to talk about my memo. I wasn't intending to try to threaten this company.
Oh, please, Theodore. Don't try to peddle mouse crap to the mouse. I've been around Goofy Drive a couple of times. Of course you were trying to threaten us. You guys couldn't continue to work unless you had the assurance of a long-term commitment to your show.
Well, I was being metaphorical.
Look, you're being paid more money than the entire cast of The Lion King.
Well,
now get serious. You'll put out that show and do it with commitment and energy if I don't give you any reason to believe it's going to be on the air past Bill Maher's pimp's birthday.
All right. Look, Mr. Mouse.
Call me Mickey. When you say mouse, I don't know. Maybe it's me, but I detect an attitude there as if, I'm the king of TV journalism and I have to report to a frigging rodent. Well, guess what, Murrow Man? You do. It is a small world, after all.
All right, Mickey. Let me be absolutely straight with you. We've done excellent shows for you for more than 2 decades.
Only because nobody on the cartoon floor of the building gave a flying frog. You know, every once in a while, Donald would squawk about the animation of his whole daytime show on the Disney Channel being cheaper than the opening graphic of your show. But,
well, for whatever reason, we got viewers. We made money for this network.
You made money when this place was owned by the Cap Cities people. The Goyim! The humans!
Well, all the same, as broadcasters, they did have a dedication to the importance of news and public service.
Mm-hmm.
And to be truthful, I've never sensed that dedication since
we took over?
Of course. Well, the pursuit of David Letterman while denigrating the value of our show...
See, now you're saying it, and you're not even wincing.
That pursuit, coupled with branding our program as irrelevant...
Hey, Ted, that's the silliest thing of all. You got your panties all in a bunch when we called you irrelevant.
Yeah.
What did you think? That's a put-down? Please, my friend, around here, irrelevant is the best thing you can be. You think we got all those schmoes walking down Main Street thinking, oh boy, this is going to be relevant?
Well, sir, it all contributed to a sense that, and pardon me for saying this, Mickey, that you don't really care about news.
Ted, I'm at a level with you, mouse to man.
All right.
You can ask Minnie what's the first thing I do in the morning.
Well, I'm sure you order up a cheese plate of some kind.
Before that, I read the papers, Ted. Look, you ever feel like you're lacking support? Here's what I got on my plate, okay? Besides cheese. Huey, Dewey, and Louie all just got the same agent. I'm going to wind up paying 3 times as much for 3 frigging afterthought ducks. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, sir. I think I do.
You're just lucky you weren't pulling this scam when Walt was around. He'd have ended up doing the Secret Life of Walruses so fast your hair would be spinning.
Mr. Mouse, I don't want to seem as if I've come here empty-handed.
Mm-hmm.
If there's anything we could do to develop the Nightline brand for rides or park attractions...
Oh, sure. The Rwanda famine could work real well. Kind of like a model cafe, only more depressing. Ted... Please, get out of my sight before I puke all over my gloves.
Well, sir, I am grateful for this time, and as I said in my New York Times op-ed piece, I am not unmindful of the nature of the bargain I have entered into. I just...
Ted, you like news? Here's a flash. From our point of view, it's no bargain. And no, we don't validate.
All right, sir. Thank you.
You think you have it tough? Not a day goes by when the boss doesn't make Donald feel like Daffy is the funnier duck.
All right, Goofy, thank you for that much-needed perspective.
That's what they don't pay me for.
Ladies and gentlemen, New York's 9 public television stations have won support from state legislators in Albany for aid in converting to digital signals, a plan that could cost the taxpayers of New York more than $50 million. But that's not all. Lobbyists are asking for $137 million for Congress for digital conversion all over the country for public television, plus another of $110 million for equipment, including digital conversion equipment. Estimated total cost of the public television transition to digital, $1.7 billion. Buy Sony stock, won't you? That's my advice. Of course. Doesn't reflect my actual portfolio. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations. Over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, on shortwave at WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz, and on your computer around the world. Think of it, wherever you want it, whenever you want it. At two locations, www.kcrw.com and www.harryshearer.com. And it would be just like the digital conversion being worth $1.7 billion if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much, uh-huh. The Sea Crane Company is proud to support Le Show, offering long-range radios, antennas, and more for over 25 years. The Sea Crane Radio Light and Science Catalog is available online at ccradio.com or by calling 800-522-8863. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.